The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, along with a man who always has a trick up his sleeve. That's Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. Did you make the trade deadline on your fantasy league, Andy?
I did. Made a blockbuster about 5 minutes to go before the deadline.
You did? Is that exhilarating for you to have that, knowing you're right on the cusp of making a trade?
It's a keeper league, and so whenever you make a deal like this, it's always like, you know, is this going to come back to bite me for like the next 6 or 7 years? So we'll see. It's fun though. I have no patience, and so it's always like win now mode. Like the Yankees operate.
Yeah, they certainly do operate that way, and
for the most part.
Yeah, well, they're having a good season. I think you should be pleased overall.
They're in a little bit of a, I don't want to say tailspin, but kind of spinning their wheels right now. Kind of stuck on the like 29 to 30, 31 games over 500 mark. They've been at this mark for what seems like 2 months now, but they'll get together. They're without a couple superstars and feeling the pinch of not having Aaron Judge and Gary Sanchez, and get those guys healthy and get ready for October.
We'll make up for that pinch with our guest today, who happens to be in New York. It's Kevin Ward, the head wrestling coach at Army West Point. Get a chance to talk with him about a variety of topics, and we get to unleash our questions about pop and other things.
Maybe, oh, yeah.
Dual meets and the importance, and we continue on our wins above replacement conversation. And if you're tuning in again, this is a very timely topic for us because we're looking at dual meets within the collegiate season and how to make them more exciting. We're saying a way to do that is through cumulative scoring. So if you score 7 points in a match and you win, you get 7 points for your team. If you lose by six, or you score 6 points and you lose 7-6, the loser gets 6 points for the team. If you get a fall, it's worth 22, and a tech fall, it's whatever you get for that amount. And we're going through and creating our own statistics. We did 125 pounds 2 weeks ago when we had the show. Now we've broken down 133, and want to make a point here. Kelly had emailed in and had great things to say about the show, and we appreciate that. She also wanted to ask a clarification question. If you are, let's say hypothetically, winning a match 8-6, and you get a fall, all of the points that you might score in that match are now null and void. So
it's 22. Yeah, 22. It's plus 22, right? Or minus 22, depending on whether you score the fall or get pinned.
Correct. So there are no match points scored if you get pinned. So good question, and it's a good clarification. So I wanted to make that. Thanks for emailing in. And always contact us if you have questions or comments about what we're talking about or topics to make the sport better, because that's our main driving force with this is, how do we make it better? How do we make it more entertaining? And we want this show to be entertaining. So if you have feedback that you want to give us, at Track Wrestling on Twitter, at Wrestling Museum on Twitter, variety of ways. Go to TrackWrestling.com too and check things out. It's a good way to do it.
Yep, absolutely.
133, Seth Groves put up a monster wins above replacement number.
Point differential number.
Yeah, point differential. Okay, we're calling it that. So I still like war, because
we'll get to war though. We got to add that extra element to it.
Point differential for Seth Groves, 14.9.
That's pretty good.
He's in the Zane Rutherford category.
He is in the Zane Rutherford stratosphere.
That's pushing average of a technical fall throughout the entirety of a season, and that actually included one loss when he bumped up to 141, and so he has a negative two in there. So had that been a positive number, if he would have just gone 133 against Wyoming when he lost that match, he would be over 15.
Yep.
Monster, monster number. I'm actually going to skip to someone who was actually ranked number two for a large part of the season, as we're comparing and contrasting. He plays fourth at the NCAA championship, so we're going through all of the All-Americans. Luke Pletcher from Ohio State. Compare and contrast, 14.9 for Seth Groves, fourth place finisher. probably the lowest we're going to see for an All-American, Luke Pletcher, at a 3.38.
Yeah.
And you broke it down and just went through. Here's a stretch of his win differential or point differential, 2.7, 2.3, 4.2, 1.1, and then a 6 and an 8. So he kept him close. So I think when you gave those numbers, it was no surprise that he was going to have a low point differential.
Yeah, he was in a ton of close matches. He's just not a guy that lights it up offensively, super hard to score on. And, you know, he's hard to get to. And he wrestles a lot of really controlled matches. And so what we have Luke Pletcher, guy that went 30-4 and had a, what'd you say the average was? 4?
3.38.
It's pretty hard to do.
That's a and again with not a lot of losses. And so you compare that with Tariq Wilson, who placed third, had 10 losses on the season. He had a 4.8. So he had higher win differential, point differential with 10 losses on the season.
We're dealing with such a small sample size of what we've done to this point that stuff like this is interesting to see how it all shakes out.
Yeah. Because
there aren't a lot of Pletchers. We've yet to come across somebody like this. You know, somebody that's gone 30-4 and won so many close matches along the way that it adds up to a 3.38.
It's fascinating. And that I think that's why we needed to compare him to Seth Groves, because he was number two throughout the season, and so you just see the disparity there. Take Stevan Micic, 9.7. He was the finalist, got beat in the finals by Seth Groves, but really did have a solid season there. So he's averaging, according to our point system, in a major decision throughout the season. Tariq Wilson, as we said, 4.8. And then we go down the line. The lower half of the bracket actually was pretty solid here. Cade Brock had a 7.9. Scott Del Vecchio had a 3.8. Scott Parker, 6.7. And then a 7.8 for Montori Bridges.
I want to go back to Pletcher, because this is really fascinating to me. He scored 12.5 team points at the NCAA championships. So if you have 10 Pletchers, if you have guys like this, that's still not enough to win the national title this past year, or even the year before with Penn State and the numbers that they're putting up. But that being said, a lot of teams would love to have him.
Well, yeah, fourth place points.
12.5 points. But you look at Ohio State, that's an area where certainly you'd like to see him scoring a little bit more, his foot on the gas a little bit more. And if dual scoring was the way that we are banging the drum to see it change to, I don't think Luke Pletcher would not be as valuable to the Ohio State Buckeyes as he is now.
Yeah, absolutely wouldn't be. And I think you're spot on with that. I think that it's always an interesting topic of conversation when you talk about guys that keep it close, because you wonder why they can't widen the gap a little bit, and yet they can beat guys that do dominate, and you see that time and time again. Johnny Thompson is the classic example. There was a guy that won in the finals twice against Ryan Lewis. Ryan Lewis was blazing through the NCAA championships. This was 01 and 02, and you just think, wow, Ryan Lewis is going to dominate, because Johnny Thompson looked like he was throttled in all the matches as far as conditioning. And then Johnny Thompson has that explosion and won both matches. It doesn't really mean as much when it comes to wrestling a guy that happens to be good at getting the fall. Luke Pletcher can beat anyone in the country, save Seth Groves.
Does Luke Pletcher take over for, like, the guys like Dean Heil and Brandon Sorensen, who people are always on him to open up a little bit more?
I think he's that guy now, probably. I think he takes over that. And it was fun, though, breaking down Dean Heil's statistics, because he did get some falls early in the season. I think you're right. We may need to make that distinction between Division I competition and non-Division I.
Yeah.
I think that might be a good way to really paint a better picture than what we're doing here. We're just giving you everyone that they wrestled throughout the season, but I still like putting everything in there, because we're just trying to get a point value for what they were able to do for domination. This isn't necessarily saying this is indicative of anything other than this is what you were able to string together for your season and what you were able to do as far as domination and where you are in the pecking order.
I think the one thing about Pletcher that's really fascinating, and this speaks to the the sport as a whole. It doesn't matter if you're a long, tall, rangy guy like maybe Tariq Wilson is, or if you're short and stocky like Luke Pletcher is. You can find a way to play to your strengths, and Luke Pletcher certainly has done that by staying in sound position, not making mistakes, and then capitalizing on the opportunities that you get.
So with that being said, great point there. Should he change? Should he just stick with that game plan? Because that's what he's winning with. I know we want more points and more entertainment, but if that's the way he wins and he's scoring points for your team, why change now?
Well, I think if you're an Ohio State fan, you'd certainly like to see him taking more opportunities, giving himself more opportunities than he has. You know, that's what you see is guys that walk the high wire there, and they're in a lot of close matches. Sooner or later, they fall. You know, it's just really hard to see somebody win consistently when they're in that many close matches.
Going to ways that we can improve dual meets, Barry Davis had contacted me recently. We just had him on the show after he had retired from Wisconsin. It was a fantastic interview. Enjoyed having him here at the Gable Museum for that interview. He had said that he was going back to an idea that we had talked about, and that I think it's valuable to not have just the order of the dual meet be 125 through heavyweight or random draw. Let's put the best matches in order. He felt like, hey, let's take a step and let the fans vote on the best three and then rank it. So the one that gets the most votes is the last match of the dual meet, two and then three. Make it a Twitter challenge. I think it has legs. I think it engages people in the social media realm. I think there's some real merit to doing that. I'm just throwing this at you for the first time, but I think it could be neat to have that number one versus two as the last match if it's 125 versus being the first match. I'm in favor of that. I think it's what MMA does. I think it's what boxing does. It works for them. Why would you have the best match potentially first?
I'm for that. I'm okay with that. I don't know that you want to throw the whole order out of whack.
And he's saying, let's not throw it all out of whack. Let's just say, let's vote on three matches.
So the best one goes last. All right, cool.
I think it could be
fan engagement potentially. I think that'd be really cool to get fans involved a little bit more.
Yeah, and so Barry used the Penn State Iowa and saying, hey, how do we get fans in the week leading up to it? They vote on potentially 157, 174, and 165. And then the top vote getter goes last, number two goes second to last, number three goes third to last, and then you just go in order up until that point.
So if you get you get Barry Davis and you've got a big 125 pounder, are you sitting at home like stuffing the ballot box to make that last?
I think you do everything you can to play to that. You call all your friends and have them vote. And I don't know what the social media outlet would be, but
it's like the Kansas City Royals. Remember that year where they had like eight starters in the All-Star game? Something silly like that. For the longest time, they were dominating at every position in the fan voting. It's been like 3 or 4 years ago, but clearly they were stuffing the ballot box.
But
Kansas City,
some merit to it. I think that we need to think more like what Barry's talking about. And again, you just use the example of when Conor McGregor and Floyd Mayweather fought. They didn't fight first because they weighed less. They were the headline event.
Yeah.
You need more of that in dual meets. So as we're talking about ways to improve dual meets and streamline it so that you have accumulation of points, why not put the best matches last? And the one that always sticks out to me is you had a rematch of the NCAA tournament finals, Matt McDonough and Nico Megalutis, and that was the first match the next year. Why would you ever do that? That should be the last match. Make that the showcase. Let's not have Spencer Lee be the first match. Let's make him last. Let's make the Iowa Hawkeye fans stick around to the very end and have the build up because he's going to be the show for the next 3 years.
What did this start like 20 years ago where the draw came into play?
Yeah.
Right. And then was it 02 up in Minneapolis that Jay Robinson, Jim Zaleski decided that they were going to start at 125 just for the promotion's sake? And
oh, yeah.
It's a good match right away with Leroy Vega, Luke Eustace. It was going to end up with Mako and Garrett Lowney, I think, going last, and they told me. I remember one of them said before the fact that I think maybe both of them even said, and I wrote it, that they agreed they were going to start at 125. I think both guys ended up having to sit out a dual meet because of that.
Really?
Yeah.
I remember that being happening, but I didn't remember them having to sit out a dual meet. So I don't know what that would entail if coaches decided to do that. I think probably the NCAA would have to get on board with it. I don't know if coaches can just choose order how they want to, but I think there's probably stipulations that if it's not a random draw, it has to go from 125 to heavyweight. I'm not quite sure what the rules are on that, but I'd like to see them test the rules. I think it could be fun to see how that plays out.
Let's try stuff, right?
Yeah, let's see what it looks like. You were at the NWCA convention. I don't want you to tip your hand too much because I know you're going to write about it, but just any general thoughts you had on the convention and what ideas were generated there.
Yeah, it was fun to be down there and just listen in on some of the meetings, sit in on some of the meetings and the breakout sessions and learn a little bit more about what goes into getting NCAA legislation changed and what a slow process that can be and why they don't push for certain things on an annual basis. That stuff was pretty interesting. The talk about RTC reform potentially coming into play here.
Elaborate on that because that's a great topic.
Well, I don't want to give too much away for
your column, but
but
you could just generalize.
Yeah, there's obviously a pretty wide discrepancy now between the haves and have-nots in college wrestling, and a lot has to do with the RTCs and the money that's being thrown around in RTCs. And certainly they have been tremendous for what they have done for wrestling in the United States. I don't think anybody can argue that they haven't been hugely beneficial for what's going on in completely tied to what's going on with USA Wrestling's success a year ago. Four world champions at the cadet level, junior world champions, senior world champions in men's freestyle. I think that you can tie that all back to when the RTCs came into play. That being said, I think that there are a lot of coaches around the country that would like to see them tightened up a little bit. I don't think anyone wants to see the RTCs go away, and I think that there is that maybe a little bit of fear that the NCAA would come back and say, if you guys don't get control of this, we're not going to support this anymore and pull the plug on it. And I don't think anybody wants to see that. And so I think coaches are working hard to get some things tied down a little bit more with them. And
any other topics that I know that we wanted to talk about that, but any other things that came up that are exciting for the future of the sport?
Well, I think this is another one it's more of a behind the scenes thing, but just the APR and the emphasis, the financial ramifications that could be in play and long-term ramifications that could be in play if schools aren't making sure that, athletes are doing well in the classroom. And when we talk about the potential looser restrictions on transfers, transfer candidates having maybe more freedom than they've ever had before, the fallout from that is what does it do to the APR numbers at each school if kids are coming and going and that could be a pretty slippery slope, I think, for college wrestling. And so that's one thing that was a heavy point of emphasis down there. Is I think that ties in with why there's so much push for a one semester, second semester sport right now. The academic performance and wanting to see wrestling flourish a little bit more on that end of things and certainly insulate itself a little bit more in terms of getting to the point where programs are safer.
I know it probably didn't come up at the NWCA convention, but one thing that I'm just surprised by is the Iowa Intercollegiate Athletic Conference, which is a Division III conference, is now the American Rivers Conference, all because there's one Nebraska school in the formerly known as Iowa Conference. I don't like it.
I'm not a fan either, right?
I don't think it's right.
There are a lot of rivers in America.
I know, and it just
what kind of
American Rivers
branding is that?
I'm just appalled by that. All because Nebraska Wesleyan happens to be in it. They're trying to be more inclusive. It's just like the Big Ten. It's just like the Big 12. They don't have 10 teams in the Big Ten, but you keep it for branding. You don't mess with the Iowa Conference. It's the premier conference in Division III. I think they botched this one. And I know it's just a name, but I'm not happy about it, Andy. You shouldn't be either. You're shaking your head, and I get it too. We're Iowans. And this is not a good thing. It's not the American Rivers Conference. It's always going to be the Iowa Intercollegiate Athletic Conference to me, Andy.
Well, let's not refer to it as the American Rivers Conference then.
We'll call
it the Iowa Conference,
yeah,
right?
Just like I've called it Budapest, and that's the proper pronunciation, and you refuse to say it. You're saying Budapest, and I actually like it better that way too, but now that I know it kind of digs at you a little bit, I
don't
right.
Like, I don't have a problem with it. I'm just not going to say it that way.
Yeah. Just like
same thing with American Rivers Conference.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not going to refer to it.
We're going with the Iowa Conference.
It's going to be the Iowa Conference.
For life. Our guest today, all the way from New York, Kevin Ward, head wrestling coach at Army. How are you, Kevin?
I'm doing really well, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
Great to have you on the show. Tell us about West Point and what it's like to be the head wrestling coach at a military academy. I'm assuming you live on base. What's the environment like for you to be the head wrestling coach at a military institution?
Yeah, sure. It's quite an honor. I can start with that. It's quite an honor and a privilege to be able to lead such a storied program, and especially at a place with so much history and prestige as West Point has. There's different facets of life here, and in a lot of ways, it's really unique and much different than probably any other coaching job in the country. And in a lot of ways, it's very similar. And the essence of what we're trying to do here is the same thing that they're trying to do at any other major Division I wrestling program, which is, you know, train and coach guys to reach their fullest potential on and off the mat and become national champions. I would just say that coaching at West Point is really special, because we get to be around some of the best people in the country and some of the best people in the world on a daily basis. So I consider myself pretty fortunate in being able to interact with the types of people that I do here, you know, the country's best and strongest leaders. So it's a pretty unique opportunity and a pretty special one that I consider myself pretty fortunate to be a part of.
Recruiting is always a question mark when it comes to military academies, because there is a process to get in. How do you approach recruiting at Army?
So I think the first steps of our recruiting process are very similar to where it would be anywhere else. I mean, it's no different than any other program, and that recruiting is maybe the key and most important thing that we do. Obviously, developing our guys and taking care of them while they're here is extremely important. But without the recruiting piece being in place, you're at a disadvantage from the start. So, yeah, recruiting is the most important thing that we do. You know, we want to recruit the best people that are the best wrestlers in the country. And, you know, we cast a wide net, and we want guys that are competing to win national titles in high school, because we want competing to win a national title in college. And, you know, I think if you look at the success we've had recruiting over the past 3 years with three classes ranked inside the top 20, you get a feel for, you know what, success in recruiting is definitely possible here. It's communicating to people what West Point is and kind of dispelling some of the things that it's not, some of those maybe preconceived notions in people's head. We can't take everybody. That's just the reality of it. If academically they're not strong and don't show the potential to be successful, then we can't look at them. And if there's character issues, you know, they're probably not somebody that we can recruit. So, yeah, there's some challenges, but we get asked this question all the time. But my response is, you know, recruiting anywhere is hard when you're really trying to recruit the best guys, and we're trying to recruit the best guys. So there's some certain challenges. There's some certain things about recruiting at West Point that make it pretty easy to recruit too. You know, we don't have to be very creative when you're trying to sell West Point. You know, you don't have to try to make things up to make West Point sound impressive. It's impressive, and everything about it speaks, you know, for itself. So there's certain challenges. I think the benefits far outweigh it. But you're right in saying it's one of the most important things that we do.
Andy and I have an ongoing commentary about your newly hired assistant wrestling coach, Ned Shuck, and that it's not an official wrestling tournament or event unless Ned Shuck is there. He is absolutely everywhere. How did you recruit Ned Shuck to be part of your program?
Yeah, well, that's where it starts is, you know, he's got a really good reputation in the wrestling community. Just by word of mouth, I heard a while back, hey, here's a guy that's just absolutely working his tail off, and everybody likes him, his teams are performing really well, and you should look, you know, at hiring this guy sometime. And I said, well, I don't really have anything open right now. Told Ned to give me a call. Ned did. He followed up that day. We spoke, and I said, man, I really like you. We don't have anything open. If we do, I'm going to give you a call. And it was maybe 5 or 6 months later, we had an opening and called. And we had, you know, a pretty interesting and really strong pool of candidates for our head assistant coaching job. But he just, you know, it was obvious from the start. He separated himself from the pack. And I guess what attracted, you know, me to wanting him on our staff as head assistant is, you know, his reputation with, you know, his integrity and character being, you know, beyond reproach, someone who comes from a really strong wrestling program where he wrestled at the University of Iowa, coached by really strong coaching staff, so he's had really strong influences, and then he kind of paved his own way after that, you know, went out on his own and head coached at high school level, collegiate level, and been around some incredible mentors, and he works his tail off, so you put all those things together, it's really a no-brainer to bring him on board. And I'm really glad that we did.
And just even think about it from the level that he shot me a text and said, hey, you should have Kevin Ward on the program. Not many assistant coaches, and in fact, I think that's probably the first one that's ever done that in the history of this show, that said, hey, been proactive and said, you need to get this guy on the show. And I'm glad we have, and I appreciate him doing that. Have you seen glimpses of that already, that he's proactive in his approach?
They're in every single way. Just, you know, when I told, you know, Coach Spate, I said, well, have Ned call me. Ned called me later that day. I mean, there is nothing assistant coach about Ned Shuck. He is a head coach. And he is a head coach right alongside me, whatever title you want to give it. I mean, that's why he's here, is because of his experiences, what he's been able to accomplish. And he's been able to accomplish those things because of his work ethic. And he doesn't sit around waiting for things to materialize. We've had conversations, you know, since he's been here for the past few weeks, you know, give this kid a call. Let's look at this kid, recruit him. Let's move forward with this plan. And I don't have to call and check and see if he's done it. So there's a lot to be said. There's a certain magic in just putting your head down and going to work. And he is a very workmanlike individual that when you say you need to get something done, he's going to get it done, and you don't have to check in on him again. It's going to get done.
How did you get here? How did you get to Army, and how are you in the position you're in right now?
Oh, man, yeah, that's a great question. A lot of luck, a lot of good fortune, and, you know, good timing, a lot of support from other people. I have an interesting path in the coaching world. I had a good collegiate career at Oklahoma State, not a standout on those teams that won 4 national titles, but was around some really good guys and mentors and coaches. But when I got done wrestling, I decided to step away. I did the graduate assistant thing for a while. When I got done with graduate school, I decided I was done with wrestling for a while. So I thought I was done with wrestling forever. I actually worked in the Oklahoma oil fields and the oil and gas industry for a couple years until I just missed wrestling so much I couldn't take it anymore. And went back and got alternative certification to teach high school. So I was going to be a high school coach. And I was offered one job I didn't want, the one job that I really did want, as an assistant coach. I didn't get it to be an assistant high school coach. And it wasn't long after that. Pat Smith and a guy named Greg Hatcher called me from Arkansas and said, hey, we've heard you've been trying to get back into the sport. We have an opportunity that we think you're going to like. And it was being the head coach at Wachita Baptist, which was a startup Division II program. And long story short, I accepted that job and moved to Arkansas and picked up and moved from Oklahoma to Arkansas in about 10 days. started a program from scratch, and 4 years later, we finished fourth in the country with five All-Americans, and I was Division II National Coach of the Year 4 years into being a head coach. And some opportunities opened up. I was really happy at Wichita. I wasn't looking or even really wanting to leave. Thought we had a team that was going to win a national title the following year. But when West Point called and the opportunity opened up, I knew right away I was going to take it if I was offered the job. So, you know, the real answer to your question is I worked hard. I caught some lucky breaks and had some support of some really really great people along the way. And, I'm sure glad because I get to be the head coach at Army West Point now, which is pretty cool.
Kevin, I heard I had another question in mind, and then I hear I worked in an oil field. Tell me what you did there. What kind of work were you doing there? What was that like?
Yeah, sure. So one of my college teammates, he grew up in the oil field, his family, and they still do. I've worked in the Oklahoma oil fields forever, a few generations, and he was the first one to, his name's B.J. Jackson. He hooked up with a job, and my first jobs in the oil fields were doing what's called flowback work and some roustabout work, but, for about a year, I was pulling a camper around behind my pickup and staying on location. So I would stay in a camper on these well sites after they drilled and made a well, and pretty much check the production of the wells every hour, 24 hours a day, report back to engineers in the home office, help plumb in a production equipment on the surface. This oil and gas and water comes out of the earth and has to be separated and filtered and turned into a product, that we can use at home. So I was kind of on the ground floor of that, so to speak, working actually in the field, on the well, staying on location for weeks at a time. Kind of parlayed on to an office position with a company called Chesapeake Energy in Oklahoma City. And it wasn't long. I loved the company and I loved the people, but it wasn't long after being in an office that I knew I didn't belong there. So that's really making the move from the field to the office is probably, more than anything else, what helped me transition back into wrestling. But I liked working outside, I liked working on the field, but then going into the office and staring at, 5 feet of computer screens with nothing but Excel sheets all day and engineering diagrams, it just wasn't for me. So it was an interesting path. What I think oddly prepared me to be a coach. I really learned how to work with a lot of different people from, the guys that are working on the drilling rigs to the engineers that are in charge of drilling wells to the engineers that are in charge of getting that oil and gas from the wellhead to the consumer. So you get work with a diverse group of people in a lot of different ways. And I think that experience in a funny way really did prepare me to be a head wrestling coach.
We could probably spend an entire podcast talking about leadership from what you've learned, with John Smith and now at some of the, I'm sure there's some incredible leaders out there at West Point. Can you give us a little bit of a sampling, maybe some bullet points of some of the valuable lessons that you have learned personally since you've been out there at West Point, and maybe even some of the things you learned from John?
Yeah. What a great question. It's everything that we do at West Point. Our job more than anything is to, educate, train, and inspire leaders of character. So leadership is everything that we do. A story I like to tell is I've been to West Point for a couple weeks. I've been here and we had an athletic social. Our former superintendent, who had just retired, was at the athletic department social, and was fortunate enough to meet him, General Kavlin. And one of his pieces of advice to me when I first met him was, you're going to set the standard as a leader. And if you do, your wrestlers will rise to it. I thought that was a really powerful leadership lesson. And what he meant was, if you set the standard, not just in what you say, but in what you do and how you act and what you expect and demand out of your wrestlers, they're capable of rising to it. And I think one of the strongest lessons I've learned is, one of the worst things you can do is underestimate somebody. And the best leaders I've been around are demanding and they're tough. but not in a difficult or a mean way. They just, it's because they believe in you and they believe that you're capable of doing some pretty incredible things, maybe more than you think you're capable of doing. You know, that's what it's about at West Point, is holding people to a high standard, being honest with them if they don't reach it. And if they don't reach it, you know, finding out why and helping them, you know, reach their potential, whatever that is. And, you know, when I look back on my time at Oklahoma State, when you, since you asked, and, you know, it brings to mind a lot of the best leaders that you're around are kind of informal leaders. You know, they probably don't even view themselves as leaders. They may not study leadership. You know, they don't read books about leadership. But when you start to study them, everything that they do is everything that you read about in leadership. And, you know, I think John was that way, and just being extremely demanding, extremely tough. And was never for a second going to sacrifice the standard of Oklahoma State wrestling for somebody else's, you know, feelings or what they thought that they were capable of or the program was capable of. So, man, I've just learned so much from a lot of really good mentors and a lot of strong leaders. You're right, we could talk about this all day, and I would love to. But I'll just say this. Coaching at West Point, these last 4 years has taught me more about leadership, you know, than the previous 31 years of my life combined. It's a pretty incredible place, and produces leaders better than anywhere else in the world.
What's it like to be a civilian in a military environment?
Yeah, so the military environment is, in athletics, we're almost entirely civilian. So in my athletics world and our athletic department, it's all made up almost exclusively of civilians. There's a few military people. And on the campus side of things, we're walking through campus and visiting with, you know, whether it's professors or officers that work here, other people that work with, you know, they're all military. It's so much more seamless than I ever would imagine. There's a learning curve, there's no doubt. But when you get down to the root of it, everybody is here for the same reason, no matter what uniform you wear. If you're me and you wear khakis and a polo, or whether you've been in the Army 30 years and you know, you're wearing a military uniform, we're here for the same reason. And that's to be able to train and inspire these young people to be their best. So I'm telling you, it's not that much different than living and working anywhere else. It's just people wear different clothes.
Now, do you live right on base? Does it feel like you're part of an Army base when you have your daily life? Does your family go grocery shopping outside of the base? How does all that work?
Yeah, that's so interesting. Because let me tell you, I mean, I had no idea moving here. And my wife didn't come on the interview, so she had even less of an idea of what it was going to be like. It's like we live in Mayberry. And I tell everybody that, and I mean it. This is like Andy Griffith could be my next door neighbor here. You know, West Point is a small town with a school located inside the gates of West Point, you know, the academy. But it's just like we live in, I think, just like any other gated community. I mean, but it's, we live in a gated community, and, my immediate neighbors are coaches, and there's all kinds of people that work at West Point that live right down the street. It's like living in Mayberry in the Hudson Valley of New York. It's incredible. There really couldn't be a better place to raise a family. But yeah, we live right here. I mean, my commute is like a mile and a half to work every day. And the only traffic I face are, you know, the 400 strollers going by to the elementary school in the morning. That's the only traffic I have. It's a pretty incredible place to live.
The military academies, whether it's VMI, Navy, Air Force, do you feel a connectedness to those programs versus other Division I programs?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think there's a mutual respect and understanding that it would be impossible to completely know unless you coached at an academy. You know, there's an intense rivalry, too, that you can't understand unless you're a part of it. But, I mean, there's certainly, you know, a respect and understanding for what really what these young men and women at the service academies commit themselves to do, because, you know, they sacrifice in a lot of ways what would be considered the normal college experience, you know, so that you and I can sleep well at night and not have to worry about it. And when you look at it that way, there's a tremendous amount of respect between the service academies. And yeah, I think it's something you couldn't understand unless you're a part of it. It's pretty special. I would say the rivalry is only outdone by the respect between the academies.
So taking that, you've been part of the Bedlam series, Oklahoma versus Oklahoma State. How does that compare on the intensity scale? Army, Navy.
Let me tell you, and you know, all my friends from college are going to tell me this, there is absolutely no comparison. Nothing that you can imagine compares to the rivalry between Army and Navy. And the rivalry with Air Force is strong too, but there is nothing. There's no other rivalry. When I was in college, our rival was whoever was ranked second in the country. You know, and that varied each year. It could have been OU, Minnesota, Iowa. We are fortunate here. It doesn't matter what your rank. You have the most intense rivalry every single year. There's really nothing that compares to it. It means so much to so many people, literally around the globe. It's hard to describe, but, you know, hopefully this kind of helps paint a picture, you know, from national duels, championships that we won and lost when I was in college, you know, from any other heated rivalry between us and the second-ranked team in the country, nothing compares to a head-to-head competition against our rival. There's nothing like it.
So I want to get this straight. You're saying that the intensity of Army-Navy is more intense than Iowa-Penn State will be.
And it's not even close. And you're going to think I'm crazy for saying it, but what you need to do is come out here February 24th next year, 23rd, whichever that dual meet is, and come out here and sit in our gym and watch the dual meet and feel the energy, watch the intensity on both the benches and the sidelines, if you want to call them that. It sounds crazy until you're in it, but there's absolutely nothing in the world like it.
So I'll take it a
step. I don't think the presidents of those of Iowa or Penn State, no disrespect to that rivalry, it's a great one, but the presidents of those schools aren't going to be sitting there, you know, 10 feet from the bench getting after and getting involved. It's that level. I mean, it goes all the way up to the superintendent. If they're involved and they're passionate about it, it's just such a special, unique rivalry.
Well, let's mention another rivalry. Andy Hamilton is a diehard Yankees fan. If I was bloody on the side of the road and I said I need help, if it was in the seventh inning of a Boston Red Sox game against the Yankees, he would not show up. I know that for a fact. Where does it compare, number one, with that rivalry? And number two, have you caught the Yankees fever? Are you a Yankees fan?
So it's so easy to go to a Yankees game here, so I guess I was that. I'm not trying to make any enemies on this phone call, it's like we get on a train, which is like 10 minutes from the house, and the train station drops you off. At Yankee Stadium station. And there's a stop there. So it's like it's incredibly easy. So I've been to a couple games. Personally, I like watching baseball much more in person than I do on TV, which means I don't watch it on TV at all. I don't keep up with it. I just like to go to games in person. It's pretty cool. And you know what? It's really cool. I'm going to go to a Yankees game. It'll be my treat. We'll hop on the train. We'll get out there. And we'll go through it.
Man, what awesome. Are you going to take him up on that, Andy? I mean, he is beaming over here right now, Kevin. I mean, I think what has to happen is somehow we have to get out there. We have to watch Army, Navy, the wrestling meet. You've got me so intrigued about this. And then I think, of course, it's not going to be in season. We got to get to a Yankees game.
Yeah. Well, I'm telling you, I mean, I can figure out how. It's pretty easy. We're just one plane ride away from pretty much anywhere in the country. So, you say the word, you always got a place to stay, only to have it.
So, if memory serves me, Andy has not been to a Yankees game yet in Yankee Stadium. So it would be his first game, and you could make his life complete. Would you do it, Andy?
Yeah, we may be in the nosebleeds, but it'll be my treat.
That's all right.
That'd be
sounds
awesome.
Good.
Hey, I want to go back to something you said earlier about when you said you were a good wrestler, not great, but good. What's the standard that is held for wrestling that we hold? Because we're a postseason-driven sport. Not even postseason. We're a national tournament-driven. And we base how good someone is on their placement at the national tournament. Is that fair? Is a good wrestler only based on the national tournament? Or do we need to judge the entire compilation of the season?
Yeah. I mean, it's probably not up to me to decide whether, you know, what's fair. I can give you my opinion. And I've had this conversation a few times with people, and that, you know, I look back on my career, you know, and coming from, you know, Soddy Daisy High School in Tennessee, which isn't a national power, you know, and being fortunate enough to be, you know, recruited and wrestled at Oklahoma State, where I probably wasn't recruited to be, you know, a four-year starter for sure. Definitely, and maybe not have been recruited with an expectation to be in the starting lineup. And I found myself in the starting lineup for, you know, 2.5 years, and qualified for the national tournament, 2 times, you know, the Big 12 champ and a runner up, and a guy who beat, you know, probably a dozen different All-Americans in the course of my college career, a couple guys that won national titles. And I never had a good national tournament. And I wasn't the best guy there. So I wasn't an All-American college. So a lot of people would view that as, you know, a mediocre or a failure of a career. My response is always, well, when you're in the heat of it in competition, and you have no choice but to set your goal to be a national champion, and anything short of that, short of your goals, it's okay to call that a failure. You don't have a plan B when you're trying to become a national champion. You know, in hindsight, I can look back and be really proud of what I accomplished, knowing where I came from, how hard I had to work to make things happen, and how challenging, you know, my collegiate career was. I think that certainly didn't have the success that I wanted to, you know, for a lot of reasons. And I'm 35 years old, and I still think about it. Still trying to figure out just why the hell I couldn't, you know, accomplish my goals. It'll always eat at me, but. You know, I can be really proud of my career. I do think that, you know, probably the way that we judge people at large and how good were they 3 days in March is probably not, in my opinion, fair, you know, to call on someone whether they were a great, really good, whatever you want to call it, collegiate wrestler. There's a lot of, you know, collegiate basketball players that may start on, you know, if they're on a basketball team that won 4 national titles and they started in a couple of those national championships, they'd probably be called a pretty dang good player. You know, in wrestling, if you qualify for the national championships and your team wins, but you don't place, you know, well, you're kind of an okay guy. It's the nature of our sport. You're out there as an individual, and it's not up to me to decide how people judge success. But me personally, you know, I think someone that can contribute to a winning program or find success individually, there's more than one way to judge what was a successful collegiate career. That's for sure.
Kevin, how'd you wind up at Oklahoma State?
Man, crazy story. I wasn't heavily recruited, and being from Tennessee, you know, going into my senior year, I was a 2-time state champ, which, you know, I didn't mean a lot, I think, at the national level. And I didn't place in Fargo the year before. I think I was close, but I didn't place. So I wasn't heavily recruited. It came down to senior nationals my senior year. And I had a good tournament there. I placed 4th. But this was like in April of my senior year. And I still wasn't signed or committed anywhere. I had a couple of like low money offers, but we weren't in a position to pay for college. You know, my dad raised my brother and I. And we, you know, it's like I needed help financially to go to school. Luckily, you know, at that time in 2001, you could still commit and find some scholarship money in April of your senior year with everything out. I had a good tournament there, and a couple schools, really 2 schools called me afterwards. Oklahoma State was one of them. I was really close to going somewhere else, and John called and said, you know, when are you coming on a visit? And the rest, I guess, you know, is history. As I say, I went on a visit to Oklahoma State, and I enjoyed it. I liked the culture of everybody was there to be a national and a world and Olympic champion, something I'd always dreamed about being around, and I had the opportunity to do it. So I was recruited really late, committed really late. Yeah, that's how I ended up in Stillwater.
You grew up in Tennessee. What's the wrestling culture like there? Is it an alien sport? Do they view it like lacrosse in another state? How do they view the sport of wrestling in Tennessee?
Yeah, so no, actually, you know, in the Chattanooga area where I grew up, there's actually a really strong pocket of a wrestling community that are really passionate about it, and they care about wrestling. I think when I was coming through, I was really fortunate. I had a couple of really good coaches growing up that spent a lot of time, like, helping me and some others, too. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't about me, but really developed in me. But the Chattanooga area is pretty strong. I'll say this. It's not as strong. It wasn't as strong then as it is now. I mean, wrestling in the South has absolutely exploded, and it's getting better and more popular. There was a strong support network right around Chattanooga. But it's, you know, in comparison, it's not Pennsylvania, not Iowa, not Ohio, but, you know, it's probably a little bit stronger community in the Chattanooga area than most people realize. So, I had a lot of support in wrestling growing up. It's just, you know, maybe not as intense as some other states, but, you know, there was strong support. It wasn't like an outsider, you know, type of sport. I guess when you're talking about wrestling, it is pretty much everywhere, but, you know, not as alien as you might expect.
You like horseback riding. Did you ever ride your horse to high school?
That's a good one. No, I just walked barefoot.
Nice.
In my overalls. Yeah. Well, you know, actually, I do enjoy it. But we didn't really get into horses much until like later on in high school. I have an older brother who, when I was finishing up high school, had decided to, he just packed his bags and moved to Colorado and found a job on a ranch. So when he moved off and he really, you know, full-time cowboy, you know, working cattle ranches, when I visit him and really get into it a little bit more. I enjoy it. I don't get to ride a horse around West Point, New York, but yeah, you guys have done your homework. That's a good one. I do enjoy it. As a matter of fact, I was just at my brother's last week visiting in Texas now, and so it's always fun being around it. Don't get to do it as much maybe as I'd like to anymore, but yeah, that's a good one.
Andy and I are absolutely driven to make dual meets more important, more entertaining, more of a fan-friendly event. Tell us how we do that from your perspective. Our idea is to make cumulative scoring. So if you win 7-6, you score 7 points for your team, the loser 6 points for theirs. We're looking at a 22-point fall so that it matches up against the possibility of a 21-point technical fall. Take us through what you would do to make dual meets more entertaining.
Okay, so, I mean, I think dual meets are entertaining right now. And dual meets, they're entertaining. They are important to the head coaches on the bench, and they're important to the athletes that are competing in them. But, you know, I mean, whatever I said is true. They have no postseason implications. They should. That's a start. Dual meets should absolutely matter your postseason to have postseason implications. As it is, we're all going to coach to the rules. Right now, we are about the NCAA tournament. Get your guys to the national tournament, perform well for 3 days out of the season, and that's how you're judged. It's a shame. Dual meet should mean more. I've discussed this with a couple of people. Dual meet scoring doesn't make any sense to me at all. You know, you get 3, 4, 5, or 6 points, and the other team gets none. And there's going to be some diehards that say, well, if you lose, you don't deserve any points. Okay. There could be an argument made for that. But I think that I like the way international bouncers score, where you can still score points for your team. If you score an offensive point during the course of the match, you know, it's a shame if you have a 12-11 shootout in the match and you lose by a point, your team gets blanked on that performance. And I look at a couple of examples. I can think back to a dual meet we had over the past season where we were in a lot of really close matches, like matches that came down to the last 30 seconds. I think we lost freaking all of them in the dual meet. So you look at the team score at the end and it's ugly. Like, we got beat up. But you know, I know and our athletes know that we're in every single match. You know, my concern is, hey, I look and, you know, my boss or my fans or Lucas, and you got beat like 30-3 or something. I don't even know what the score was, but it was bad. You're saying, well, it was a competitive match. I mean, don't get me wrong. The rules are the rules, and I know I'm going into competition. I know we have to win at least 5 matches to win a dual meet. I think the scoring could be adjusted. I don't have the 100% answer, but I think the way that we score dual meets and tournaments for that matter, I think that the way we score them right now, it's just not, I don't think it makes the most sense to score the way that we currently do.
Yeah, isn't it kind of ridiculous that when you go on the backside, an advancement point is worth half, so it's worth half a point instead of one, and then you keep a major decision, fall, tech fall, all the same amount, so you're rewarding that with quadruple the amount of points on the backside versus what it's on the top side. Is there any talk that that should or could change at the NCAA championship level?
No, I've heard zero talk about that. I mean, legislation and rules changes happen at a glacial pace. And to be honest, there's far more serious things that we need to address before we get to probably, you know, tournament scoring. Because the reality of it is we all know the rules going into it. And you know what you have to do to have a good team performance. You have to have two All-Americans to be in the top 20. You know, whether you take 10 people in a national tournament or two, you're going to have two All-Americans to be in the top 20. That's an example. You know, we know the rules going into it. I haven't heard any talk about it being changed. I agree with you. It's absolutely insane. One thing we did discuss at the convention this year on that topic is, you know, how many team points were taken away at the national tournament this year. And a lot of coaches feel strongly that, you know, taking away a team point is a pretty severe penalty for someone sliding their headgear over to their coach after the match, maybe a little bit too forcefully. But, you know, when you think about it, you got to win two matches on the backside to score one team point. And you get it taken away for pulling your singlet strap down too early. You go 2-2 at the national tournament and leave with 0 points. That's kind of a bummer. That was discussed, but I haven't heard any talk about, you know, a change to the scoring system. I think we should, but it's not something I've heard.
Kevin, you're the president-elect for the NWCA, correct?
That's right, yeah.
How do you wind up in that role?
So I worked with the NWCA previously when I was at Wachita Baptist. I was Division II rep and was on the executive committee. And Mike Hoyer is a guy that I would lean on for advice and somebody that I really believe in. I believe in his mission. You know, I had worked. There's a group of Oklahoma State alumni that got together this past summer, and Pat Popolizio, who's now the president, was then president-elect. You know, he's an Oklahoma State alum as well. We were sitting next to each other talking. He said he was looking for somebody, wondering if I was interested, you know, in serving as vice president, president-elect. I said I was. Whatever discussions were had, you know, they chose me and voted me in. I'm not sure what those were, but I'd worked with Mike previously, and, you know, I'll just say that the NWCA is a pretty impressive, impactful organization that does a lot more than for the sport of wrestling. So anytime I have an opportunity, what I told Mike was, hey, if you think I can help, I'm willing to try. If you think there's somebody better that can help you more, go after them. If you think I can help, I'm willing to try. And, you know, so my guess is nobody else wanted the job, so it's me. You know, I'm going to try my best to help them out. I really appreciate the organization of the NWCA, what they do. So any way I can help, I'm excited to do it.
Even more important than the advancement of wrestling and dual meets is, what are your thoughts on soda? Is it good for you?
Yeah,
would you drink it?
Yeah, so, all right, we got to start with the root of your question, which I can't really call it soda, right? Where I grew up in Tennessee, everything is Coke. So it doesn't matter what it is, Mountain Dew, Dr. Pepper, whatever, everything is a Coke. And then I don't know, maybe I call it pop now because of my time in Oklahoma. Long story short, I rarely drink it anymore. It's just coffee and water for me, maybe a couple other things. Hey, if it makes you feel good, go for it. You know, I'm not the diet police. I'm not the nutrition police unless you're on my team. Then that's my job, but each their own, you know. It's not for me, but you know, if I had to, I'd grab a Mountain Dew and be happy with it, but you know, I'll leave that one to the experts.
So Mountain Dew would be your choice if it came down to it at a restaurant?
That's it. Yeah, that depends where I'm at. Maybe Coke, ginger ale, but I don't do it very often. But I'll have one every now and then.
Okay, what do you say? We're going to play a game. We like to play games on this show. How about we play a game of the hot box? We ask you five questions, hoping to make you sweat. Kevin Ward, are you ready to go into the hot box?
It's like 100 degrees here, so it's perfect. Let's do it.
All right. Number one, name one five-star general.
General Franks.
General Franks. I don't know. I'm going to take your advice or your word for it. I have...
Why didn't I say Eisenhower? I was just in Eisenhower Hall like 10 minutes ago, too. Why didn't I say Eisenhower?
Yeah, Eisenhower's right. Bad. Yeah, you got
can
it there.
Can I go back to Eisenhower? Okay.
Yeah, Eisenhower's right on point there. All right, question number two. Name one song that has the word Tennessee in the title.
Tennessee Whiskey. That's an easy one.
Yep, you got it.
Tennessee Waltz. I mean, we could probably keep going.
We could. I was going to give you a bonus if you would have done Tennessee Flat Top Box because I like Johnny Cash. So,
but you know, that was next.
But you got it. Question number three. 30 college wrestling programs will be added, but it's predicated on your mom and your wife shaving their heads. Would they do it?
Oh, my God. Kids, can we make it 35? That would be... Yeah, that would be a lot easier.
35? Five more?
Maybe if I get on the phone with you, then it's guaranteed to happen.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm going to hope they take one for the team here. Question number four.
Yeah, for sure.
If you and John Smith wrestled right now, who would get the first takedown?
He would get the first, the second, the third, the fourth, and the last takedown. I would love to say, you know, that maybe he's getting old and I could take him, but let's be honest, he's the six-time world champ. I'm not taking the guy down. Not the first time, not the last time. He's too freaking good. He's the greatest ever and will remain the greatest ever. The guy is absolutely unreal. You know, maybe it's me and a couple friends. I get the first take.
All right. Respect. I like that answer. Number five, and you're out. What would the name of your movie be about your life story?
That's a fantastic question. I don't know, man. Maybe Lucky Breaks, Dumb Luck. I don't know. I've had so many twists and turns. I never thought I would end up where I'm at now. You know, I would say there's a lot of luck and good fortune involved.
Well, I mean, after Andy's question, I would think something with the oil fields would be in the title somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, Lucky Break.
All right, you're out of the hot box, and we are totally planning on you doing a feature called Where's Ned Chuck? I don't know if it's a Facebook page or something, but you have to just put some sort of a pin on the map on where he is in any given time during the course of the season, and we'll be following that.
Listen, I can't put a pin everywhere. I can barely keep up with the guy. You know? like a Where's Waldo, I'm going to put a red and white striped headgear on him when he goes around recruiting at these tournaments. You'll be able to pick him out of the crowd. But just be on the lookout. Ned Chuck's going to be all over the country, coast to coast, recruiting some of the best.
All right, we appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the program. It's been a blast. For Kevin Ward and Andy Hamilton, I'm Kyle Klingman. You've been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.